small firm entrepreneur architects. Get ready to build a better business with the Entree Architect podcast, where business meets architecture. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, the host of Entree Architect podcast. Join me every week for inspiring interviews with passionate people that share proven strategies to help you build a better business.
If you think there is a problem, one, you can't make a move until you have a plan in place. The accountability chart really helps plan, okay, for the business 6 to 12 months out, this is what we need.
We cover it all, from financial management to marketing, sales, productivity, and beyond.
There's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work. So you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work. So you charge way more.
I'd also say lagging measures, one of the best, like the best. So for any client, for any professional service company, if you're going to take one thing away from what we're talking about today, is to look at a number called the labor efficiency ratio.
Entree Architect is not just a podcast. It's your secret weapon for success. With over 500 episodes, it's one of the longest running architecture podcasts in the world. You're sure to find the information you need to elevate your business. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now and join the community of small firm entrepreneur architects building better businesses.
I'm not tired of coquito. I'm tired of making it.
Fair.
It's so easy.
I guess. I was going to say, it's so you're tired of blending? Like,
yeah, but I always make a mess and my hands get sticky and I'm like, ugh.
Oh. Are you mixing are you it doing with it your right? hands?
Yeah. I'm doing the old-fashioned way, baby.
Hey there, welcome to season 11 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season, we were inspired by the number 11, which is, as you know by now, a pair of ones. So this season's theme is pairs, duos. We are talking about ladies who were a part of a professional pair in some fashion.
As always, we are not experts. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find. You know, as friends having a fun conversation. So if you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning.
All right. On today's episode, we will finish our story about Lin Huiyin, the first female Chinese architect who was also a poet and preservationist. I'm Lizzie Rahr, getting into the Christmas spirit with some coquito in San Francisco, and I'm joined by my fellow co-hosts, Nurjiti and Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti Rivas. Deciding if I'm going to make coquito this year in Houston, Texas.
It's a question?
The real question is, I'm Jessica Rogers, and I'm deciding how much coquito I'm going to drink this year, based out of Miami, Florida.
All right, listeners, this is a part two, okay? So if you haven't listened to last week's episodes, stop it right here, and you go back, and you listen to it. But even for those who did listen, let's do a quick recap of last week's episode so we can know where we're at in the story. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So Lin Huiyin was born on June 10th, 1904 in Hangzhou, China. Her dad was a government official and they moved to Peking or Beijing in 1912. Huiyin's father meets Liang Qichao while working in Peking and they scheme a marriage between Qichao's son Liang Sucheng, and Huiyin.
Luckily, they told them that they should decide if they want to get married. Like, it wasn't forced on them. But obviously, the dads think it's a great idea. So, Huiyin and Sucheng stay in touch.
In 1920, Huiyin goes with her dad to live in London for a summer. There, she studies English and becomes fluent. The family also becomes close friends with the poet Su Qimo. Qimo falls in love with Huiyin, despite being married, and it looks like there's about to be some drama, but it gets shut down, and she and her daddy go back to China.
Meanwhile, Huiyin is writing poetry over these years and becomes a very well-known poet over the years. Then, in 1924, Huiyin and Su Cheng both enroll to attend University of Pennsylvania's School of Architecture. They decide that they'll go to school and finish studying before they get married.
Unfortunately, UPenn isn't allowing women to study in architecture school. Her father tried to lobby for her to get into the program, but it didn't work out. She was still able to take classes in the architecture school, but in the end, she graduated with a fine arts degree in 1927 rather than architecture.
Yeah, and Su Cheng also graduated in 1927 with his architecture degree. And then on March 21st, 1928, they would get married in Canada and would go on a European honeymoon before returning to China.
Okay, we're all caught up. Huiyin and Su Cheng are headed back to China. In 1928, they were asked to come to Northeastern University in Shenyang. Shenyang is a city northeast of Beijing in Manchuria. And at this time, the city was occupied by Japanese troops, which made it a bit dicey. But they decided to go, and they helped start the architecture department at the school and taught there. This was the second architecture school in China and the first to use a Western curriculum model.
She's part of starting a college now. If that's not totally legit, I don't know what is. Who needs to get a college degree from some naysayer university? Just start your own and let all the ladies in. Ladies were allowed, right?
I hope so.
Good question. I don't actually know, but I mean, if she's teaching there, I would guess so. I couldn't find that out, but...
Okay.
While they were in Shenyang, Huiyin designed a railway station in Jilin, the province just north of Shenyang. This is one of the few buildings she actually designed.
I mean, if you're only going to design a few projects, for one of them to be a railway station sounds amazing. It has a chance to be iconic, used by a lot of people, and there's so many systems to coordinate.
Yes. Sadly, the Japanese invaded Manchuria in 1931, so Huiyin and Su Cheng had to abandon their fledgling program at the university and move back to Peking. Huiyin had two children during these years, a daughter, Liang Zaibing, and a son, Liang Kongji.
Sad that they had to leave their program, but happy that they had a chance to grow their family.
Yeah. During these years, they also learned that Huiyin had tuberculosis.
Oh, snap.
Yeah. Definitely not ideal. And I didn't mention it earlier, but back in 1923, Su Cheng got in a motorcycle accident that left one of his legs injured to the point where he had to wear a back brace from then on and suffered from a limp.
I see we made it to the depressing part of the episode.
Oh my goodness. This is a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so they're back in Peking, and they design a house for themselves to live in with their kids. And they start hosting parties and meet this couple named John and Wilma Fairbank, who are living in China. John is a Chinese historian, and Wilma studies Chinese art. They became fast friends and had a lifelong friendship.
Good for them.
So, during the 30s, Huiyin and Su Cheng started to really delve into finding, recording, and promoting preservation of historic traditional Chinese architecture. China was in an era of modernization, and they were realizing that there were so many buildings throughout the country that hadn't been recorded at all and should be noted and preserved. This sparked them going on adventures to various places in China to measure and photograph these historic buildings.
Yes, I love this. I really want to do this. Between this story and a few weeks ago, the story we had on our Bolivian architect, and episode 91, Yasmin Lari, I feel like the universe is giving me signs.
Right?
I love to see it.
So, in particular, they spent a lot of time in the Shaanxi province. It was a more interior province in China, which hadn't yet been touched by modernization, but also hadn't been hit by all of the wars in the last 1,000 years because it was cut off by natural features such as mountains, rivers, and deserts.
Lucky.
This made it perfect place for Huiyan and Sucheng to go visit ancient structures that were still standing and document them. In 1934, the Fairbanks joined them on an expedition. They went to find the Temple of Guangsheng. The trip was 70 miles, and Wilma later wrote that the, quote, summer rains had turned the road to gumbo, so the antique Model T Ford they had hired gave out after 10 miles. They transferred their luggage to mule carts, but were soon forced by the soldiers of the local warlord, Yan Xinchen, to take the back trails, which were transversible only by a rickshaw. When the tracks became bottomless jelly, the four were forced to walk, led after dark by a child carrying a lantern.
What a crazy adventure.
Yeah.
These descriptors are hilarious. Road to gumbo tracks, becoming bottomless jelly. Who knew jelly could be bottomless?
Well, they eventually made it to the temple, and the monks let them sleep in the courtyard under the ancient statues. The temple was built in the year 147. It went through a few iterations over the centuries and was damaged in an earthquake in 1303 during the Yuan dynasty, and was rebuilt years after that. There were repairs made throughout the years until Huiyan and Sucheng came upon it, but it's said that the building still holds the style of the Yuan dynasty from the 14th century. The main feature of the temple is a 13-story tall pagoda called the Flying Rainbow Tower. It also has amazing murals from the Yuan dynasty.
Need to see pictures of this now and add it to our Ark Ventures list.
They continued to measure and document ancient Chinese architecture over the next few years and essentially became the authority on Chinese architectural history and were the first preservationists of Chinese architecture.
Yes!
Beautiful.
In 1936, they climbed on the roof of the Temple of Heaven in the Forbidden City in Peking to measure it, and Huiyan became the first woman to climb on the roof of the Emperor's Palace.
History in the making.
Ba-bam!
In 1937, they made one of their biggest discoveries. They discovered Foguangsi, or the Temple of Buddha's Light, near Dukong in Shanxi. The main hall was built in 857 AD during the Tang Dynasty. It's a fully timber structure, and at the time they discovered it, it was the only known remaining Tang Dynasty timber structure and the oldest fully timber structure discovered in China. Today, it's the fourth oldest timber structure in China.
Wow, imagine walking and stumbling upon something so historic and virtually one of a kind.
So, like, Huiyan is basically the Chinese version of Indiana Jones. I love it.
That's a good, yeah. Yeah. Sucheng wrote a letter to the Fairbanks describing the experience and said, quote, in complete darkness and amid the vile odor, hardly breathing, with thick masks covering our noses and mouths, we measured and drew and photographed with flashlights for several hours. When at last we came out under the eaves to take a breath of fresh air, we found hundreds of bedbugs in our knapsack. We ourselves had been badly bitten. Yet the importance and unexpectedness of our find made those the happiest hours of my years hunting for ancient architecture.
Oh, okay, first off, ew. Second, that is some major dedication. And third, ew. Like, I'm itchy. Like, ew.
Yeah, I was like, okay, cool.
Couldn't be me.
All right, so remember, we talked about Japan invading Manchuria in 1931, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, now it's 1937, and they are fully invading China. And this starts the Second Sino-Japanese War, which would continue until 1945 and later become part of World War II. Japan ended up capturing Peking and Shanghai in 1937. So Huiyin and Sucheng had to flee their home in Peking with their children and go south.
Glad they were able to make it out.
Yeah. But this also put a stop to their expeditions in northern China and their work on the cultural sites in Beijing. They went to a few places in southern China over the years, Kunming, Tianjin, and Lishuang. They stayed through the end of the war, and Huiyin was often bedridden from her tuberculosis symptoms.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I forgot that she had that with her Indiana Jones adventure.
Yeah, uh-huh. But this whole time, you know, he has his leg injury and she has tuberculosis, and they're still going out and doing all of this. The
things that this they is do. Crazy.
Through rickshaw and gumbo roads and jelly land.
Bottomless jelly.
Bottomless jelly. And bed bugs. And
But they did it all.
Yeah. After World War II, they were able to return to Peking, and things seemed promising. In 1946, the couple helped establish the architecture department at Tsinghua University in Beijing. And in 1949, Huiyin became an architecture professor there.
Finally, some good news!
Yeah, geez.
Yeah. Sucheng went to the U.S. in 1946 as a visiting professor at Yale, and was the Chinese consultant for the United Nations building in New York City. A former classmate from UPenn, Alfred Bendinner, was nominating to get Sucheng an honorary degree from UPenn, and he sent over a copy of Sucheng's CV for him to review and make corrections. On a list of all the buildings that he designed, he edited every single one to say, "and Lin Huiyin," or "in collaboration with Lin Huiyin."
This is the definition of duo. Great respect and support.
Well, you can tell that they were truly a team, right? And he considered her an equal. And many articles I read said the same thing. You couldn't tell which one of them worked on what because they shared the work between the two of them.
Yeah, I love it.
So things were looking up. Then in 1949, the Communist Party won elections. At first, Huiyin and Sucheng were in support of the revolution, but it became clear quickly that their vision for China didn't align with Mao's. Mao wanted to essentially get rid of all of China's feudal heritage, which was completely opposite to Huiyin and Sucheng's vision. They felt that China could modernize and still pay tribute and preserve its history.
This is really complex. I mean, I find history extremely valuable and believe we need to be knowledgeable in it in order to move forward. But I understand how certain history is very painful and someone else's response would be to erase it. I just don't agree that that's the right approach. I'm with Huiyin on this.
Yeah. So they were involved with the design of the national flag and the national emblem. They also designed the Monument to the People's Heroes, an obelisk that sits in Tiananmen Square. It got built, and it still stands there today.
Well, that's really powerful. I wonder how it was for them to work for a government that they didn't necessarily believe in.
Yeah, true. I'm wondering if they thought of the government in one way, and they started doing all this stuff for them, and then it became a totally different thing. Or maybe they just saw it as an opportunity to create this new modern government, and they didn't realize that it was going to become all, like, anti-history, haywire-ness. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they were hoping that being part of it, they could help influence it in a direction that they believed in. Because I think they were still initially, like you said, Jessica, I think initially they were excited about the possibility of the new government. So they worked on a massive plan for the city of Beijing, which focused on preserving historic architecture and constructing new buildings. They believed that the old city would become a park and that the new construction would be put outside of this so as to keep the integrity of the old city, but still allow for new infrastructure. Kind of reminds me of Paris and how they've done this.
Yeah, this sounds great.
Well, Mao didn't agree and completely rejected their proposal. One of the main things that they were hoping to save was the old inner city walls, but Mao ordered all 25 miles of the walls torn down. At the time, Beijing was the world's largest and most intact walled city. A U.S. scholar said that the tearing down of the wall was, quote, among the greatest acts of urban vandalism in history.
Speechless.
How sad. Urban vandalism. That is strong.
Yeah. After this, Hui Yin and Su Cheng were kind of out of the inner circle and were shunned because of their views and their background as highly educated intellectuals.
Ever notice how intellectuals are always considered a threat by governments?
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. Sadly, in 1955, at the age of 51, Hui Yin died of her tuberculosis. Even though it's so sad that she died so young, she lived way longer than any doctors thought that she would.
Wow. For her to be only 51 when she passed, she was able to do so much.
Yeah. So I know normally our story ends when our lady dies, but I do think that I need to give you a bit more info of what happened after Hui Yin died and to tell you what happened to Su Cheng.
Oh, okay. An epilogue.
Su Cheng continued to work and teach and ended up getting remarried to a co-worker at the university, Lin Chu, in 1962. Then, in 1966, the Cultural Revolution happened in China.
I thought you were going to say that he got a concubine. To, you know, bring it back, you know. Okay, let's talk about this Cultural Revolution, also known as the Great Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. This was a socio-political movement in the People's Republic of China. The goal of this movement was to preserve Chinese communism, which meant that they would get rid of traditional and capitalist elements of Chinese society. It was a revolution that went on for years, where people were persecuted and universities were being shut down. It seemed like a very tumultuous time period.
Yeah. Sadly, Su Cheng was caught up in this and was forced to be, quote, re-educated in his beliefs and also forced to wear a sign around his neck that named him as a reactionary academic authority. He was beaten and stripped of his position. He and many co-workers at the university were imprisoned or sent to rural areas as part of the, quote, down to the countryside movement. He died in 1972.
Oh my God, that's terrible. I didn't know about any of this. How awful for after so much love for his country and its history, his life ended this way.
Yeah, this is awful.
Obviously, all of that is so horrible, but there is a bright spot because Lin Chu, Su Cheng's second wife, she hid all of his notes and manuscripts and all of the work that he and Hui Yin had done over the decades. Years later, she and Wilma Fairbank were both able to compile and publish so much of the work that Hui Yin and Su Cheng did. Their legacy lives on because of these women, and many of the buildings they documented are no longer standing. Wilma published two books, A Pictorial History of Chinese Architecture, of their works, and Liang and Lin, Partners in Exploring China's Architectural Past, a book that chronicles both of their life stories and career. The second one was a big source for my episode.
Yes. Shout out to these women preserving Wei Yin and Su Cheng's work. I love it.
Yay. Good job. Amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know we keep going, but one last thing that we have to note especially because Jessica mentioned it, but the University of Pennsylvania finally awarded Huiyin a Bachelor's of Architecture degree posthumously in 2023.
Good job, Penn.
Yeah.
Yeah, like 2023, like we were recording this in 2024, like this is last year. And when did Huiyin pass away? When she was 51. And that was like still long ago, in the 60s, early 70s.
50s.
In the 50s? Are you kidding? I mean, good job, Penn, I guess. But oh my God.
Yeah, I mean,
we're here.
We're glad they finally did that.
Yeah, it's better than nothing. But my goodness.
Our collective anger.
Yes.
Yes.
And our collective happiness.
All right.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Any final thoughts on Huiyin?
This story, I'm so glad we did it in two parts. Like, yes, it's always great to listen to how these duos worked. I love to see a couple that supported each other and that Su Qing was, like, by her side, you know, like, defending her contributions. It's also really interesting learning about China's history. And how that impacted how they worked. And yeah, I mean, Nurjiti mentioned it too. I love the idea of preservation and how they were able to do it. It's always really cool to see, minus the bed bugs.
All right, we've now reached the second part of our episode, the caryatid. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who's working today, furthering the profession through her work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode. Liu Wenyu is a Chinese architect and professor. She and her husband, Wang Shu, met while studying architecture at the Nanjing Institute of Technology and founded Amateur Architecture Studio in 1997. The firm focuses on natural materials in their work, like wood, stone, and mud. Wenyu also teaches at the China Academy of Art in Hangzhou.
Ooh, okay. You know, I love me some mud and some stone. Also, I like that both of them got their architecture degrees around the same time, not 30, 40 years afterwards. Also, hey, partnership caryatid.
Wenyu said that they've named their architecture office Amateur Architecture because they were trying to fight against the, quote, professional, soulless architecture that was being done in China. One article said, her techniques are rooted in Chinese tradition, but she insists that historical knowledge should be a springboard for her students and herself to explore new and inventive ideas.
I was wondering why they would choose that name for their firm. I agree with their motto that historical knowledge should be had, and from there, improve upon what has been done. But with that base rooted in history.
The springboard. Yeah. I agree about the name, but maybe it's meant to mean like the elitist way that architecture can be. So they're trying to say that they are just amateur or like regular. Like they're not elite. They're more like wholesome. You know,
yeah.
More approachable.
Mm-hmm.
The studio won the Pritzker Prize in 2012 for their projects.
I mean that their work is an amateur, okay? Pritzker Prize award winners.
All right. Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of projects that we've talked about.
We hope you enjoyed learning about today's lady and caryatid, along with our banter, and that you're inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your colleagues, your history buffs. Tell them all. Also, give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify. Write us a review. This all helps us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise at shebuildspodcast.com/merch.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website, shebospodcast.com/donate, or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebillspodcast. You can also find links to all of these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at SheBuildsPodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, SheBuildsPodcast.com. Or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at SheBuildsPodcast and on X at SheBuildsPod. Bye.
Bye.
Adios.
It's like all I have are sound effects and one words. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Ba-bam.
You can elaborate.
Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach.
By becoming NCARB certified, like I did, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses.
Learn more at ncarb.org.